Hello, and welcome to the Brad Pitt Cast, the podcast about Brad Pitt. I'm Dan.
I'm Joseph.
And today, we're here to talk about the film Seven.
We were discussing this before. The seven in place of V doesn't really work. It doesn't make any sense.
It is something a teen etches into a school desk when they're bored with no thought.
Pivotal film for us. Important film for us.
Essential film.
Because it's one of the most iconic Brad Pitt performances.
I think it's a... It forms him in the public's mind in some way.
I think so.
He's also dating Gwyneth Paltrow at the time, which is important.
He is kind of
conceptually, right? For Brad Pitt the person as opposed to Brad Pitt the character.
And he is, for the first time, working with David Fincher, who becomes his kind of one significant artistic and creative collaborator.
Mm.
We've discussed before that Pitt is not the kind of... Like, you look at someone like Tom Cruise. When Tom Cruise first gets big, Cruise immediately starts loaning out his star power to other filmmakers.
Yeah.
Like, he works with Oliver Stone, he works with Tony Scott, like, he works with these directors with, like, a very clear vision. Pitt does not do that. So far, the most substantial director that we've talked about is Neil Jordan for Interview with the Vampire.
Well, I guess it's Ridley Scott for Thelma and Louise.
But he has no star power to use at that stage.
Yeah.
He's not someone who likes working with auteurs, except for Fincher.
Mm.
Which means that it's an exciting opportunity to talk about one David Fincher, who is a filmmaker who I adore. I don't know if you adore David Fincher.
I like David Fincher. I think he's actually... I was thinking about this during the credits of Seven.
Which go the wrong way up the screen.
But it is very juvenile, isn't it? Like, I'm on board with the project. But it is something a...
I love this film. I should just come out and say I adore this film.
That makes sense. I think that makes sense. I'm on board with this film broadly, I think. Although I'm still reflecting on it. He has an adolescent aesthetic... sometimes contrasted with this incredibly sophisticated and thoughtful and pensive aesthetic, and that dynamic between those is really interesting.
I don't know if I agree about him having an adolescent aesthetic.
There are sketches of knives in the credits.
Sure, but I think Fincher is dead serious about his craft.
Definitely. It's, so are teens.
But he's also much more sophisticated.
Yeah, for sure. I think that's absolutely true.
It's unbelievable that Seven is somebody's second film.
Yeah.
After a first film that famously went very badly. Do you know the story of his first film?
No, I don't. Okay. Alien 3, right?
Alien 3. Let's do a tiny bit of Fincher.
Is that the Joss Whedon Alien?
No, that's
okay.
The fourth
okay.
one. Which is directed by Jean-Pierre Jeunet, who is the director of Amelie. Insane string of directors. Who would replace Ridley Scott and James Cameron? Let's get a guy who's never made a movie before and the dude who made Amelie. Fincher is a music video guy.
That makes sense.
Who hones his aesthetic and hones his technical practice with music videos. Then he gets hired to make Alien 3, which is a film that famously had like a whole bunch of different drafts, some of which were quite extreme.
Hmm.
So there's a New Zealand filmmaker called Vincent Ward who does a draft of Alien 3 that is set on a planet where everything is made out of wood. And it's like, the script is available online. It's amazing. So the studio just couldn't crack it. They didn't like that pitch. So they bring Fincher on, I think now in retrospect, so they can bully him. They don't want a director.
Oh, sure, like the Marvel philosophy.
Absolutely. You get some newbie who feels indebted to you and then you can fire them if you need to. And Fincher famously has an awful time on that film.
Is it a good film?
Some people defend it. Hmm. It's not bad.
Does it look like a Fincher film?
Yes. It's already like extremely well technically directed. The problem is just the bar is so... I mean, Alien, one of the best films ever made. Alien's one of the best films ever made. And Alien 3 is just not... There's also, like, where do you go? Like, Alien is a gothic horror film. Aliens is a war film. They try and make it a prison film. It doesn't work. But there's a quote about Fincher making that film, which I adore, which is that, I think Charles Dance, who's, like, an English actor who's in Alien 3. In
Game of Thrones.
Yeah.
And also a lot of wonderful period drama before that.
Yeah, just the guy with the crotchety face standing in the corner.
Incredible
being
face.
English.
Being judgy.
Yeah. Did you hear?
Oh, I think he was in the BBC adaptation of Bleak House. He's extraordinary in that. I think that's where I first encountered him.
There's a quote from him about his role in Godzilla King of the Monsters. And they said, talk about Godzilla King, which is a good film.
Okay.
That's not the consensus, but it is a good film.
I believe it.
And when he was asked to talk about that film, he said, the catering was excellent. Which, like, that's pretty mean, good. Charles.
Yeah, you can imagine him saying it.
He said about the experience of working on Alien 3 was that he was like, David wanted to make a fine china, like, drinking receptacle, and the studio wanted a beer mug. So they take it away from him, they strip out the interesting things, and they make it, like, quite bare bones. And then, 3 years later, not long later, he makes Seven, which is...
With some big names.
Yeah.
Which Brad Pitt kind of now is,
I guess. By this stage, Pitt is, like, Academy Award nominated.
It makes sense that he's playing opposite Morgan Freeman.
Yeah. Mm. It doesn't seem like subversive casting, although the Pitt casting is fascinating. We'll talk about it.
Okay.
I just think Fincher... Like, there are certain circles of the internet where Fincher is hyped as the be-all and end-all of filmmaking. And I think that leads to a larger cultural cringe against away from him.
Sure.
I think he's just, on a technical level, one of the most accomplished filmmakers we have. And I think when he stops making films, we will look back on him the way we look back on Hitchcock. And maybe for some people that sounds crazy.
It's a lot. It's but a big call.
The craft is unbelievable.
But I mean, Hitchcock, the reason people look back on Hitchcock the way they do is because he's doing all this stuff that's new, right? I mean, what is Fincher doing that's new?
Well, Fincher just gets a level of...
I enjoy Fincher films. I think he manages to combine entertainment and tension and reflection in a way that is... extraordinary and very compelling. Like, he's making some of the most compelling films.
And I think that's the thing. You say, what's he doing new? I don't think anybody shoots tight two-handers the way that David Fincher does. And this is not... There's a very, very good YouTube video from their YouTube channel, Every Frame a Painting, which you should watch if you haven't watched. And in that, they talk about his skill of just shooting anything and making it inherently dramatic. Mm-hmm. I just think there's nobody who has such an ability to, like... He's not showy, but you know straight away that it's Fincher. And, like, this style that you see here doesn't change. I mean, I say Hitchcock, too, because there are ways that he's, like, obviously the heir apparent to Hitchcock.
For sure, especially in regards to tension, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. But, I mean, I witnessed this film anew.
When did you last see it?
So... Shall I do my boring Seven context?
Please.
Dan, I'm sorry. We haven't recorded in a long time, and I'm back to my old bullshit. This is... Actually, I have to go and get it.
That was Joe getting up from his chair. Joe is parting the curtains to retrieve an object. I don't know what it is. I'm worried Joe's probably editing this episode, and I'm worried he won't edit this out. He's back.
This is the first DVD I ever owned.
Oh, man, that's special.
It's the DVD to the Brad Pitt, Morgan Freeman film, Seven.
I wonder what the first DVD I ever owned was.
So I bought this in high school from a now defunct DVD. What is the first DVD you owned?
I don't know.
Well, I mean, you have a demented DVD collection.
Probably a Lord of the Rings or a Star Wars.
Sure.
Lord of the Rings. It would have been the Fellowship Special Edition.
Yeah. A fantastic film.
Yeah.
A 5-star perfect film, The Fellowship. I really think that.
I think that's fair. Yeah, no, I agree. I saw it 9 times at the cinemas. Have we said that on the podcast before?
No, let's say it again. How many times did you see it at the cinema?
2001, hell of a year.
Did you go with people each time?
Yes. Yeah, I never saw. I mean, I was like 12.
You never went solo?
I don't think so. I wasn't seeing movies by myself at 12.
You know that first film and the first Harry Potter came out the same December
that's
season?
Crazy. I mean, because Harry Potter seems so much more recent.
Harry Potter's also not very good, those films, I don't think.
They're not. I mean, yeah.
This is the first DVD I ever owned.
I cannot get over the V.
V7. This is the bonus special edition of Seven.
Can I hold it?
You can.
Thank you.
So I got that...
Deluxe.
I got that when I was like 14 from a defunct video store, which had probably had some dumb name like Easy Whatever, some stupid thing. And I bought that, and I bought it blind. I hadn't seen the film before.
Oh.
And I bought it blind because I was a common visitor of the IMDb message boards.
Sure.
And I remember, like, as we've discussed in the podcast, I was obsessed with horror movies. And in particular, back then, before I was all about horror, I was all about villains. Mm-hmm. And people on the IMDb message boards would do, like, the top 6 villains of all time. And Kevin Spacey's John Doe was always at the top.
Oh, interesting.
So I was like, I got to get this film. And I bought it. And I do think, like, I had lots of other activating films. Like The Cook, The Thief, His Wife and Her Lover was like a major film that made me love cinema. this was like a fetish object for me.
Huh.
I watched it obsessively. I've watched this film.
I had no idea about this.
Yeah, I was huge on it. Not only did I watch that film, like, constantly, I watched that film with the Brad Pitt, David Fincher film constantly. They do a commentary together. I watched it, like, 100,000 times. There's a making of on the John Doe notebooks in that DVD. I watched that, like, 100 times.
Okay.
My friend Phoenix wanted to borrow the DVD, and I...
You didn't?
I was like, you can borrow it, but please, like, this is really important to me, this object. And his cat scratched the DVD. Flip around the cover on the on here.
Oh, it's got claw marks on it, which are kind of match the aesthetic of the art, DVD art.
My friendship with Phoenix was never the same.
Yeah, sure.
It didn't entirely recover from him allowing his cat to fuck up my copy of Seven.
Odd for a cat to scratch a DVD.
Yeah.
Case.
I like a lot of things that I was obsessed with at that time.
Sure.
I think in my early 20s, I had like a slight cringe against it.
Yeah.
The film. And then I think after the release of like Gone Girl, I felt like, oh, Fincher is a major director again. It just like completely got me back on. And it made me realize that this wasn't like some teenage, my first director crush. In the way that a lot of people like love Tim Burton,
yeah,
because he's so distinctive and he has this flair, and then you grow up and you realize like Burton is probably not major, is some people's opinion. I actually think he's a fucking genius, but it re-taught me, and rewatching the film again, I'm of the opinion this is kind of a perfect object, this film.
That's interesting.
What's your history?
My history is that I would have rented this film from the Blockbuster down the road.
When you're how old?
Probably 17, I would say. I remember thinking it was pretty good.
You're very sensitive to violence.
Yeah, I'm getting into violence. Well, it doesn't
getting
have... maybe even 18 or 19, to be honest.
But you sound like Fuji was even Clockwork Orange, like getting into violence.
The drugs. It's just as I'm beginning to be allowing myself to be exposed to it. But the thing about this film is you don't really see anyone... You don't actually really see any acts of violence.
There is a horrendous implied bit of violence.
Yeah.
As I say, I've seen this film so many times. I know what you're talking about. It's so bad.
It's dreadful in the most pure sense of the word.
The lust murder is...
Basically unthinkable. Yeah. You can't pay attention to it, really.
No.
I think this is a... at the time, I remember thinking it would have been one of the first films I saw that was like this. I remember having an understanding of it as a serious film, probably, so I liked it for that reason enough. But going back to it, I think it's a bad script. I think it's a straight-up bad script.
I think it is an unbelievable script.
Yeah.
I almost think the script is the strongest thing.
That's interesting. I think it's the weakest. I think Fincher does extraordinary work, given how bad the script is. That's
going to be one of these episodes. Maybe.
I just, just profoundly juvenile and dumb.
Oh, it's so dumb.
Like, the spacey monologue at the end is embarrassing. It's so on the nose. He just repeats himself a bunch of times and says all the quiet themes of the film out loud. Someone seems to be committing 7 deadly sins. We know this because they're writing them at the scenes of the murder. Better go to the library and read vaguely all about the 7 deadly sins. The reason I said before the podcast that I had doubts about this film, and that I imagine you can might be able to convince me. The reason I think you could convince me is the sense I have of this film is it obviously is doing like outsized, grim, cartoonish, New York is hell, graphic novel style, intense vibes, right? Although it's interestingly, they never in the film mention that it's New York, but it does say on the back of this deluxe special edition DVD that it's shot in New York City precinct. And I think you could maybe make an argument that this film is being insanely camp on purpose.
Sure.
And that is coherent with the... And I think Fincher does that quite well, but the underlying, it just feels like it's built on termite-infested... pillars to me.
I've got some things to say
please.
To you, Daniel Dixon. When you and I watched All That Heaven Allows, the Douglas Sirk film, early in that film I said to you, this is a sci-fi film. It could be set on Mars.
Mm-hmm.
I feel the same way about Seven.
You talk
about the cartoonish... there's something about the fact that this was shot... To me, I don't actually know. I haven't heard anything about this. Although in the commentary, Pitt mentions that they used rain towers.
It's shot in LA.
Is it really?
Yeah. Look, I saw that somewhere when I was looking at stuff yesterday.
Because it has it doesn't this feel, feeling yeah, of like... It doesn't feel like Earth. It's bright, but constantly raining. You can tell that they're rain towers, I guess. Yeah. There is an artificiality to everything that happens.
There's this scene where it's a wide shot of it running across the street that is extremely rain towery. It's these sweeping sheets of water.
But if I want to set up a theory of the film, and then we can maybe break down on a more...
Yeah, I have no idea what it's about.
I think it's about what happens when you realize that the world is an inherently evil and or doomed place.
Yeah.
And the two responses you can have to that are be like Somerset, the Morgan Freeman character, and try and make like tiny differences on a day-to-day basis, but like broadly go along with it. Or do you be like John Doe and try and construct some kind of like mirror image to the evil within the evil? Sure. I think it's basically an argument between Kantian idealism and like consequentialism, where Somerset is the person who's like, let us try to the best of our abilities to just mitigate as much goodness, you know. Yeah. It's why very early in the film, Somerset sees this murder and he says to the other police officer, did the kids see it?
Mm.
And the other police officers are like, fuck you, fuck off. And Somerset is just like constantly thinking like, how can we in whatever way just mitigate the evil as it stands?
Mm.
Whereas Doe builds from the evil this rigid, as you say, quite silly and cartoonish project based on these like very anarchic and like anachronistic kind of visions of the world. Like there's a reason why they're like reading Dante and talking about all this stuff.
It's Miltonian.
So he's constructing something out of the evil that is rigid and unfeeling. I think where the film lives is in the face of Morgan Freeman.
Sure.
As somebody who just... I think we should go macro in a minute, but like the scene where Pitt is trying to remember the name of the guy who died, who got shot in the arm, and Freeman is in the front of the car, and it's
a great scene.
Indescribable look on his face of just like, he's so sad, and he's spent all his life trying as best as he can to do very little precise changes that mean nothing, and then he encounters John Doe, who has tried to construct something massive.
Well, what's Brad Pitt's role in that?
Freeman thinks that, like, he is the mental cop to Pitt, and that he is teaching Pitt how to be more like him.
Mm.
And Pitt becomes part of John Doe's project. So the tragedy of the film is that Somerset spends the whole time thinking he's mentoring this guy to be more like him, and, you know, you have to try and mitigate as best as you can. Sure. And instead, Pitt is completely subsumed by the project, to the extent that he becomes John Doe. I mean, that's... John Doe passes the mantle from himself to Pitt. So the tragedy of the film is seeing someone go that way.
I buy all that.
Entirely
convinced. No, all that makes sense to me. I'm kind of interested in that. But I think the weakness of that for me is just the neo-Kantian Kevin Spacey.
Do you not think Spacey is extraordinary?
No. I think he's fine. He does one thing.
I can't even understand that. Okay. I think he's Kevin
also Spacey's like this film. Like it's fine. Like I think it's a solid film. I should say that.
I think the way Spacey says he just told you, but is perfect.
I think the way I love Brad Pitt in this film.
Brad Pitt is unbelievable.
This film clarified to me how much I care about Brad Pitt more than any other that we've watched so far.
He's unbelievable.
He's perfectly well. Whether or not he's perfectly cast, he plays the role perfectly.
I think he is,
and he brings everything of himself to it, and is utterly extraordinary.
Well, it has the meta narrative that particularly fits with our podcast. That the whole point of his character Mills is that Mills wants to be taken seriously and is just considered like a young hotshot.
Yeah,
which at this stage is the story of Brad Pitt.
Well, there's that interesting thing that's never quite explained that Mills he wants to. Be in homicide in this particularly grimy, grim, dangerous precinct. And he wanted to make that movie, tries to convince Freeman of that, but it's never really explained. I don't mind that, I don't think that's a thing in the film that's lacking. But it's an interesting thing about his character, right? Like, for some reason, he's driven towards this.
I think he wants to be what Somerset once was. And he learns the baggage. It's why they have this incredibly dynamic relationship between the two. I think this is just like a superbly acted movie.
I don't think
there's a single person who's not unbelievably good.
I think Kevin Spacey lets it down a little bit. I just don't believe him as a character.
But the whole point, I mean, his name is John Doe.
Sure.
And he's literally shaved off his finger tips. So I don't find it, I'm not troubled by him being one character, because he's kind of, the whole point is that he's nothing. They want to understand his psychology, and the answer is he has none, because he's a blank slate.
What's that got to do with anything? Like, I don't understand why I want to see that in a film. That villainy doesn't speak to me at all. I want a villain who's a part. Because that's the thing, right? Morgan Freeman is like, this is not, we're going to meet the devil himself. This isn't the devil himself, this is a man. The film does not fulfill on that promise. He's not a man. I've never met anyone like that. They exist, but then and Brad Pitt's like, no, it's mental illness. Which it, like, he doesn't sell a person who has come to that site through, like, in any Freudian way, through trauma, like, or through any, like, logic of the world. Like, it doesn't make it. That's fine, you might not, but I'm just not interested in that.
But I think it works in the context of a film that you see this man's work. And then you see his construction. It's this. Have you ever seen Nocturnal Animals, the Tom Ford film? Not widely liked, but I like it because it does this incredible thing where it's a number of different narratives. It's the present, it's a fictional book that someone in the present is reading, and it's the past. And Jake Gyllenhaal's character, you never see him in the present. You only see, like, a fictional form of him and flashbacks to him.
Oh.
Although he, like, shapes the direction of the present.
Okay.
So it means that, like...
So you're talking about John Doe in this aspect. As, like, this specter who shapes...
Who you see. Yeah, for sure. See, I mean, Doe pops up in, I think, one of the most thrilling reveals and, like, the most perfectly structured reveals in, like, modern crime cinema. Raymond Chandler, the crime author, who I think this film is indebted to in a lot of ways. The dialogue is so Chandler.
That's true.
Chandler used to say when he was stuck on a book and he was struggling with a book, he would just have a character burst in with a gun. And then he has to be like, well, who is this character? Like, it naturally propels him to do something. The way that John Doe just walks up to them out of nowhere. Don't you think that's like a transcendent moment? I think it's unbelievable.
But
by that stage, you've seen this guy's like Miltonian, super intelligent work, and you're thinking that you're about to meet a master criminal, and instead you meet nobody. I think that's very powerful. You expect him to be, like, moustache-twirling, a genius, like, crazy
Liberian.
That's
interesting.
Like,
maybe
Batman
I just,
villain.
Because I saw it so long ago, I think it makes sense. Like, he's a maniac, right? Like, that seems to make sense.
I think this film is strongly implying that he's going to be, like, like a Dante professor gone mad or
that's
something
interesting.
Like that. And instead,
he's
nothing.
I didn't feel that, but I buy that. I mean, a lot of your points are persuasive. Like, the structure... you argue it inhabits is persuasive and like makes it maybe more intelligent than I'm giving it credit for, but I still there's a lot of stuff in the script and that I'm just not interested in the problems the film is interested in.
I just think even if you're not concerned about what the film wants to do thematically, I think structurally it's unimpeachable.
Well, the problem for me structurally, and I guess maybe I would have to reflect on this, because part of me wants a detective investigation to unfold in the way that something they do makes a difference. And the point of this film is it doesn't, right? Like,
they don't
catch
John Doe.
No, it never. Nothing they do, none of their efforts actually do them any favors, ever.
And Doe is only leading them towards the conclusion that he's planned along.
Yeah, exactly. So, in fact, not only are their investigations not furthering their side of the project, it's furthering Doe's.
The better they are at their job, the more they lead exactly to where Doe wants to go.
Which, like...
But that's the mirror image thing, right? If Somerset's not a genius, if he's an idiot cop, he doesn't put together these separate crimes, and then it doesn't propel towards Doe's conclusion.
Yeah.
There has to be this symmetry. You have to have two people who've both looked at the horror of the world.
Well, does he have to be a genius? I guess there's the...
found the sloth guy who's been there for years, or if you did it, if you weren't like,
of course,
it someone has to who be, pushes the case.
Yeah, there has to be a equal. Martin, there has to be a symmetry to it.
Martin Amis always said that the problem with the theatre is that like, Chekhov can write an unbelievable script for The Cherry Orchard, but in order to have a production that's extraordinary, you need every actor and the director to be as talented as Chekhov.
Yeah.
And that's kind of what, they, like, in order for Doe's project to work, he needs every player to be as intelligent as
definitely.
He is.
And I guess, so maybe what I'm trying to do in some ways is locate this film in its cartoonishness. Because...
What did you find so overblown?
Oh, the gore, for one, definitely. Like, the extravagance of all the murders. I mean, it's very... I did 1 year of English major literature. Like, it's Chaucer, Milton, Dante. Like, that stuff is corny as hell. It's fine, but it's very corny. Ending on a Hemingway quote. It's like, these are the books that were prescribed in my introduction to English literature course. The chase, like, and I think this kind of typifies it, right? Like, the chase when Brad Pitt is chasing Kevin Spacey, wonderfully shot sequence. But if you think about that in the context of the film, okay, so Kevin Spacey's grand plan is to have Brad Pitt miss him a bunch of times and him to, like, not quite shoot Brad Pitt. Like, they have to have, like, it's the kind of Stormtrooper Star Wars thing, right? It's like, okay, well, we need to just accept. And that can be fine in a particular kind of film.
I don't mind that here.
I just don't know if it... Also, and I went back and forth on this throughout the film, but is the entire function of Gwyneth Paltrow in this film to end up with her head in a box?
No, I don't agree.
I asked a question.
I know you did. I don't think so. I think she feeds into the tragedy. Paltrow is easily, you know...
She does great work.
She's unbelievable.
She's really good. In this film.
The Brad Pitt cast just becomes me defending controversial people sometimes.
And Paltrow's a great actress.
Paltrow is a fantastic actress. We lose
the counselor,
sight.
I look forward to The Counselor when we can talk about her.
Yeah, we lose sight of what a good actress she is.
Yeah.
I mean, Gwyneth Paltrow's not in The Counselor.
Isn't she?
No.
Oh, am I thinking of
Cameron Diaz?
Cameron Diaz, I'm so sorry.
Daniel Dixon.
Two blondes.
Now we have to do the Cameron Diaz podcast.
Yeah, we do.
You know Diaz.
To be fair, I knew Diaz was in The Counselor. I think I thought they were both in it. But
you know Diaz she records The Counselor throughout doing Rihanna's accent, a Barbados accent.
Oh, that's right.
And
I've forgotten
the studio
that.
Pulled her to re-record all her dialogue because even back then they're like,
wait,
we can't do this.
Doesn't she still have a weird voice?
No, her voice is pretty normal, but she's stylized in kind of problematic way that's coded
crazy.
Into the character. Unbelievable film.
That's a crazy film.
This is the thing, right? This is what I'm talking, or my feelings about the film structurally, is that everything that you're talking about is so tightly woven. Paltrow does need to have her head in the box at the end of the film.
Sure.
But you care about her and you love her, and she is the one beam of light in this deliberately very dour film.
Yeah.
She is so
also
likeable.
Having just been to New York, it is very funny seeing the city, this film's vision of New York.
Yeah.
It's like so... It's hell. It
it's
thinks
hell.
New York. Like, they literally descend. It's. I mean, also, like, it's so, like, oh, Dante and New York is hell. Like, these are not very interesting ideas.
Where else have they done that well, though?
I think it's a B+ film, right? It's like, oh, these are corny ideas funneled through a very competent and effective director's vision. That's like, it's like a super corny film that is magnificently rendered. That's my understanding of this film.
I think, like, so to go a bit macro, the first 10 minutes of this film, you see Somerset in his bedroom. You discover what he's like as a character. You learn that he is retiring soon. You see the gluttony murder. You meet Brad Pitt.
Yeah.
You understand Brad Pitt's dynamic. You understand how Freeman and Pitt work together. And then you see Pitt in his own bedroom with his wife. And you get a quiet moment for him. So in 10 minutes, you have established character, motive, world, a plot. Freeman says something like, we have 7 days to do this. Like, the ticking clock. I think the script is ingenious. In that I think it's so tight. It moves so fast. I had kind of forgotten that Pitt walks in like 3 minutes in. You don't really
know Freeman.
Yeah, it
doesn't feel like that. It feels like he turns up later.
If you're a terrible screenwriter, you have like 20 minutes of Freeman and then you have this young hotshot come in to spice things up. Pitt comes in before you really know Freeman, but because it's so expertly rendered, you do know Freeman.
Yeah. I think that's all true. I think that's why I think it's a technically excellent film. Like, all those things are technical questions the script, for me.
I think the script is one of the strongest things in this film.
I mean, the Kevin Spacey monologue at the end is just, like, embarrassing for me. And I think that level of... There's some really cute and funny moments. There's some really, like, moments of connection. And, like, the dinner is wonderful, like, wonderfully written.
It's unbelievable. But, they're shaking the room. Pitt serving Freeman wine in a beer glass.
It's
great. Glass.
Yeah, but just... It's a good film. But it isn't... Like, it's just not that interesting. I just don't... Like, it doesn't stick with me in any way apart from its technical. I do not care about its philosophy. It's very... Like, it's very freshman, sophomore kind of...
I guess I am a thing that's carried me through my life, not just as a film watcher, but also as a reader and... I was going to say an artist, but that sounds so fucking wanky.
No, that's all right.
When I dabble in creative things, human responses to violence is one of the things I'm most interested in. And I see this as, what do you do? So, like, not to get too grandiose about it, but I think we're living in a world where you either accept the science and you understand that the human race is coming to a close reasonably quickly, or you don't. And I see the reactions to the horror, the extremely... I mean, you know, I think any problem that you have with Spacey's plan is coded into the film. He is like... You know, we always talk about it on this podcast, the way that, like, a film is like 20 billion things that needs to go right. You just, like, on a day-to-day basis... To
I
make
don't know
a
how any
film,
of them are good.
No, you can have an excellent screenplay...
Yeah, it's baffling.
And you just... Something gets... That's John Doe's project... So I see a lot of people be like, there's so many plot holes, like, what if this happened that made John Doe's project go wrong? Then it would be a bad project. The film is a mirror of the John Doe project, in that it's this vast and complicated and technically perfectly achieved work of hideous, grotesque evil. And I think that's why Fincher is unbelievable at making films about serial killers, because he is like a serial killer. He is so methodic and so technical and so grim and so treats human beings as kind of like flesh bags that there's a perfect match between what this film has to say and how it was made.
Well, I guess then you could... Yeah, again, like, that's... You could argue for the technical prowess of a serial killer, but I'm not particularly interested in the project.
Do you think that maybe part of it is because this film is so grim, it turns you off?
It's kind of not... Yeah, sort of.
It's a funny film, though.
Definitely.
It's, like, very funny.
Brad Pitt calls the Marquis de Sade the Marquis de Sade, which is amazing.
Yeah, top 10
like,
joke.
Yeah.
Unbelievable. The line, you're just a fucking t-shirt at best, is an unbelievable
Which is
line.
Also, like, I read that. I thought that was when he's yelling at Spacey in the back of the car, right? One of the reasons I really like that moment is because I think it struck me that Brad Pitt is very good at playing characters who can't quite be as articulate as they want to be.
Mm-hmm.
And in that scene, like, he's not able to muster the kind of clarity of vision he wants to when he's, like, trying to shut down Spacey. And that Brad Pitt's so good at that. He, like, hesitates a little bit. You can see him maintaining the front of someone who wants to be superior and in charge and, like, dominant in the moment, but also feel like the inadequacy that he's feeling.
And Somerset and Spacey in that scene are pitched at exactly the same place.
Absolutely.
That's the joy of that scene is Somerset's just sitting there, like, with a resignation, and so is Spacey.
It's fantastic. Yeah, that's amazing.
The film has so many scenes like that that I think are just, like, remarkable.
But I think, but I just don't care about its vision of the world. Like, again, the film does so many great things, but the vision is not interesting to me. Like, I'm not taking anything intellectually interesting away from the film.
You know,
absolutely nothing.
This is going to be a hard conversation to have, because when this episode of the podcast drops, I am still under embargo about the film that I want to talk about in this little aside.
Okay.
I watched the film that I can't say the name of yesterday. I'm skirting in trouble.
Sure.
I just saw the film as a reviewer, and the film is embargoed till the end of the month.
Oh,
really.
Damn.
But I can say what I want to say. The film is a horror film. This is like, people are going to try and guess.
I'm not responsible for any of this. If any lawyers are listening.
The film is a horror film.
I haven't seen it.
I've fucked myself now. The film is a horror film. And is an expertly made horror film. and you were Dan was going to come to the film and then didn't come. And so naturally, when I was walking out of the film, I was thinking about Dan, and I was thinking, like, what would Dan have thought? And I reflected on something that you said to me, that you were like, when I watch a very accomplished film that doesn't have, like, necessarily a huge amount of thematic weight, I have nothing to reflect on. And I think a thing that you search for as a viewer is the ability to digest films for a long time, like a snake.
Sure.
You wanna be like a boa constrictor who's just eaten a goat.
I wanna be in an ongoing conversation with the film.
I can be in that, but my conversation is with my experiential rather than intellectual reaction to the film. So when you say, what does this film take away, and I guess you're looking for something that you can be in a critical discussion with.
That's necessary for me in art.
I can just have an experience, a communication with the experience. I can call to mind Spacey walking in covered in blood with his hands up, and I can see that image and I can recall my emotional reaction to it, and it doesn't have to say or be about anything.
So my question, if I'm doing that, is like, well, to what does that refer? And if there's no answer to that, then I'm gonna move on.
That's so interesting.
Yeah, it's funny that we actually haven't come to this before, because it might have some stuff to do with our differing responses to California as well. Sure. And it's not like that's just another
the
violent film.
Not the
state.
Although fuck California. Just gonna say, I should say, I'm sorry. I've bought a whole bunch of rings.
It's inspired by Howie.
From Uncut Gems. I'm a big ring guy, and I've got rings on my fingers that keep
they're
clacking
with the glass. A it's glass. Very tempting fate. Do you know the link between Uncut Gems and Seven?
Darius Conji.
Exactly, same cinematographer, which I think...
He does unbelievable work in both.
Makes sense, right? There's a sense of, like, closeness, like, grotesque physical closeness that both films are wonderful.
Well, you know, on the closeness, you know, the Safdies, when they wrote Uncut Gems, they knew that they wanted to shoot that film on very long lenses. So that film is, like, mostly shot from a long distance away, like, way zoomed in. And handheld long lenses. That means the cameras look insane. And Conji was like, I don't see the vision here. He was initially... I mean, they speak glowingly about Conji. Like, they love him.
I think I might have actually heard... Was this on the PTA podcast? I have listened to this. I listened to it in Seattle, I think.
So it's interesting. But you can see it's a Conji.
Yeah.
He's an unbelievable cinematographer.
He's done... Because I looked him up after when I found that out. And he's done a bunch of films that I've seen.
He's a really talented cinematographer. Yeah. It's crazy that we...
Don't talk more about cinematography.
Yeah,
I don't
mean
it's wild.
Like you and me.
Yeah,
even,
no.
Just like the
just
culture.
In general, it's strange that they don't have... Like, I feel like we even talk about editors more than we talk about cinematographers.
Yeah. It's interesting, too, that, like, Pitt doesn't work with many big-name filmmakers. He doesn't work with many big-name cinematographers, either. It's probably Conji, and The Assassination of Jesse James is lensed by Roger Deakins, who is, like...
I feel like I know the name.
He's probably the most famous cinematographer. He finally won his first Oscar for Blade Runner 2049.
That's right. And of course.
He's also extremely handsome.
Yeah.
He's like a classically really good looking guy who speaks in this like very gentle British voice. There are hardcore Deakin stands out there.
Should we talk more specifically about Pitt in this film?
I'd love to.
Like we haven't really focused on it. I think this is... I want to say this is his best performance so far.
It's possible. It's an unbelievable performance.
It's perfect, right?
It's perfect.
I think.
That's what I mean when I talk about the film as a stylistic, like as a perfect object.
Yeah.
Pitt is tuned perfectly into this project. Cast perfectly.
Yeah.
He comes with the weight of someone who's, like a marquee idol who doesn't want to be that anymore.
You can feel the city from which he's come in him, right? Somehow.
Yeah. He's dressed in these, like, ridiculous oversized with, like, big oversized
big
ties.
Big collars and ties, yeah.
There is a scene that you should... You are welcome to borrow my... It has the commentary, a commentary with Fincher and Pitt. And... Fincher talks...
I would actually be really interested in
it's
that.
It's great. Like, there's this crazy moment where they're talking about how originally in the scene where, like, the house is rattling, originally Pitt was going to say to Freeman, they were going to have this back and forth where Pitt was like, thumb recall. And Freeman goes, what? And Pitt goes, whenever someone gets arrested for a violent crime, you should cut off their thumbs. And then when they get released back onto the street, you can always pick a violent criminal because they don't have any thumbs. And Freeman apparently goes like, huh, thumb recall. And it's this tiny exchange, and Pitt and Fincher are talking about that. And then Pitt goes, honing his stand-up then already, Pitt goes, it's the same. When they do stunts in major motion pictures, they should get guys from death row. So the stunt actors don't have to risk their lives. You just chuck them off the building.
Oh my God.
And then there's a little pause, and there's this very clearly retroactively added bit where Pitt goes, I'm not serious. But it's unbelievable. Fincher is also... Have you ever heard an interview
with Fincher? Think I have, actually. I mean, I probably have, but I wouldn't be able to call up his voice.
It's a great voice. He has a very sardonic sense of humour. You know, too, the story... Sorry, you did say we were going to talk about Pet.
No, it's quickly. Fine.
You know, Fincher is famous for doing hundreds of takes.
I didn't know that, actually.
Like, a grueling experience as an actor to work with.
I always feel distressed about that.
So there's this roundtable conversation where, I think it was for the Oscars, it's Ruffalo and Ed Norton both talking, and Norton, who's the star of Fight Club, and Ruffalo, who's the star of Zodiac, which...
Oh, yeah, I've seen Zodiac.
Might be Fincher's best films. Okay. I think another perfect film.
Huh.
Do you not like Zodiac?
I don't remember. I just remember watching it and thinking it was good.
It's an unbelievable film. I think you should revisit it.
Okay, it's long, right?
It's a lot, but it's...
Sure.
It's perfect. and in that roundtable conversation, Norton says to Ruffalo, I feel really lucky when I saw Zodiac that I worked with Fincher when he was shooting on film. Because he just...
Oh, you're limited.
He was just limited. Yeah, he just couldn't shoot all day. But on digital, he can just... And Ruffalo's like... Ruffalo tells the story that on the set of Zodiac, they did like 100 takes... And it was his first day on set, and he's just doing the same thing over and over. And apparently Fincher, like, comes over, adjusts a light, and then walks back past Ruffalo and, like, pats him on the back and is like, hang in there.
Oh.
There's also an audio commentary with Freeman on this disc, where he talks about...
Just Freeman?
Yeah.
Oh, weird.
Yeah. Do you know Freeman's a weird dude?
I think I've heard tell.
He's a weird dude. Have you heard the story that Jonah Hill tells?
I don't think so.
They were both in a car together shooting some film, and they didn't talk for the whole, like, 4 days of shooting till Freeman on the last day was like, Morgan, for Forgan, Morgan, and, like, does this, like, long, complicated rhyme, and then does, like, now you do your name. And Jonah Hill's like, what? He's like, do your name. Jonah Hill has to be like, Jonah, Jojona, Babona, and that's their only interaction on set. Freeman said working with Fincher is great because Fincher leaves you alone as an actor.
Huh.
And he just uses you like set dressing, which I think you can see from a filmmaker standpoint.
In Seven, that makes sense.
It's
definitely. They're not that distinct from the set.
No. So you...
Just moving objects.
You think this is Pitt's best?
I think so, yeah. I think it's his first super accomplished role.
What do you think about his reaction at the end?
I think it's great.
I think it works really well.
I think it does. I think it's excellent. And when he says, my God, afterwards and stares at the ground, I think it's really felt. And
the way he's holding the gun, it's genuine tragedy.
And it like is this combination of all we've had with Pitt throughout all the films that have come before, right? Of this intensely physical and emotional actor who suddenly finds a role where that perfectly fits. And not just fits, but feels... kind of has the dynamic between being contained and restrained, like that wonderful scene where Freeman is telling him that he can't break down the door, and Pitt clearly just all he wants to do in the world is break down the door. Yeah. And there's that, like, Brad Pitt is so good at like being a rubber band that's about to snap and then snapping and it not being an anticlimax.
No.
And this film is just services those skills of his so wonderfully.
The moment where he gets in the car, which is, again, like a very funny joke, very well filmed by Fincher, who I think people don't acknowledge.
When he yells about Dante? Is that what
He gets in, he's got all the sparks nuts, and he, like, throws them against the window.
Yeah, it's very good.
Yeah. Because he is... I mean, it's something we talked about weirdly in The Irishman, which... I was talking to a friend recently, and I was like... They were like, didn't you cover a non-Brad Pitt film on your podcast? And I was like, yeah, The Irishman. And they paused and they were like, why did you do that? Long-term listeners to this podcast know exactly why
I
did that.
Part of the plan.
De Niro's character, I suggested in that film, is an idiot. I think Pitt's character here is also something of an idiot, like an oaf.
Well, he's good at oafs. He's got... He's kind of made an idiot by the world, though, right? Like, you can imagine a world in which the conditions were as such, where he kind of went on perfectly well. It's that he comes up against the evil and unfairness that is present and does not have a sensible way of dealing with it. And in some ways, reacts to it sensibly. I think Pitt's obvious behavior is totally sympathetic all along the way.
Mm, I think that's true. I think it's a cruelty on behalf of the film, but one that's obviously necessary for a range of reasons that he doesn't know that his wife was pregnant.
Yeah.
And I think that's really well done in the film.
Sure.
He's.
I think that's probably true.
It adds to this kind of... I mean, there's something that we, the audience, literally know that he doesn't know.
Yeah.
And when you have a character like that, you always kind of feel something towards them, I suppose. Mm. You feel superior to them because you literally are, epistemically.
Yeah.
What do you think about the murders themselves? You don't find them upsetting?
Oh, of course.
All of them?
Yeah. They're all upsetting. They're also all quite silly.
Do you think?
Yeah, yeah. Yes.
Making a dude eat tons of spaghetti is...
It's definitely silly. It's silly.
It's pretty funny. That we, I mean,
it's a silliness undercut by the grotesquery, right, at each stage. And the obvious, like, the silliness adds to the looming threat, like, the sense of randomness and chaos.
Yeah.
So there's it serves a purpose. But I think maybe, I mean, if you were to see any of the processes of these murders, they would be unbearable to me. I also think it's a really good decision not to show Gwyneth Paltrow's head at the end.
Yes.
For numerous reasons.
Yes.
One being, I'm sure that
prosthetics
would not
be
up to it.
Yes.
But also, I think it just works really well as a kind of sharp reveal.
Do you know the story about how Fincher managed to convince the studios to keep that ending?
No.
The studios were very anti that ending.
Interesting, because it seems that's funny, right? Because it seems perfectly thematically concomitant with the film.
I think that's something we've talked about studio heads just not understanding cinema.
Yeah, don't make the film if you don't want that ending.
No. Well, so that's what Fincher says.
Oh.
Fincher talks to the studios and he's like, listen, in 10 years' time, there's going to be a bunch of kids standing around at a party and they're going to be to each other like, have you seen that Head in the Box movie? You can't take the Head in the Box out of the Head in the Box movie.
That's yeah, what he's exactly right.
And Fincher spent his life fighting with studios. You know,
that doesn't shock me.
You know, in Fight Club, which we'll get to, of course. Have you seen Fight Club?
Yeah.
The sex scene between...
I think I've seen it more than once.
I like that film.
I
think.
Sure.
I haven't seen
we'll
it
find
in a long
out.
Time.
I think it's a solid film.
I think so. I just think... And this is what I mean about Fincher being a director who I think we'll look back on. I think he has the Kubrick and the Hitchcock thing of
They're just all going to be good.
Yeah.
I agree with that.
Competence.
It's just like, oh, this film will be good because it's directed by David Fincher.
It's why, I don't know if you remember, there were like lots of talk about Fincher signing on to direct World War Z 2.
Oh.
And he was like ready to do that. And then there was some kind of disagreement that you would expect. But everyone, I saw a lot of excitement, not because they were like, oh, Fincher's first bad film, but because like, oh, Fincher is somehow going to make a good World War Z 2.
You would go see it.
Yeah.
He's a director who I would see anything he made.
Yeah.
Definitely.
You know, they say that thing about some singers can just sing the phone book.
Mm.
Fincher is the filmmaker equivalent of that.
That makes sense to me.
You could, like, give him a script that was written by an AI and he'd give you something good.
Sure. Which is a little bit the music video sensibility, right? This sense of, which, I mean, I know a lot of directors come from that, but the sense of... You have limited time, you need to be propulsive, you need to, like, have a coherent vision, but he makes that somehow last, you know, 90 minutes to 2 hours.
Yeah. He fights the studio while making Fight Club, because there's a scene where Marla and Tyler Durden have sex, and afterwards Marla flops down on the pillow and says something, and the initial line that was in the film that they shot was she flops down on the bed and she says, I can't wait to have your abortion.
Huh.
And studio heads see it and they're like, this is fucked up. You cannot include this in this film. And Fincher says, I'll do you a deal. I'll reshoot it with a different line of dialogue. And whatever that second line of dialogue is, you can't make me change it again. And so they say, okay. And he reshoots it and she says, I haven't been fucked like that since grade school.
That's right. It's funny. I mean, it is. Look, obviously, studio heads would be very annoying. In any other context, someone who was a colleague and like made those kind of negotiations would be such a fucking pain to work with.
Oh, I'm sure Fincher is a total pain. Like, he must be. Yeah, he must. Well, I mean, we're talking now shortly after Mindhunter is no more at Netflix.
Oh, yeah.
And the
Netflix two-season rule.
Yeah, but also to the very open secrets from the beginning that, like, Fincher... Studios don't want to work with people like David Fincher anymore because he is expensive. He has a vision. You can't do the Marvel scenario of, like, bossing him around.
David Fincher's not directing, like, Guardians 3 or whatever.
No. Although, you know, Sam Raimi has just signed off for Doctor Strange 2.
Doctor, give me the news.
Got a bad case
of... Doctor Strange.
Doctor Strange. Thanks, Lights, Camera, Jackson, for providing that joy to my life. I've seen everyone get very excited about that.
Yeah, I mean, I have.
Sam Raimi is canonically one of my all-time favourite directors. I think everyone keeps expecting that we're going to get Evil Dead 2 Sam Raimi and not Oz the Great and Powerful Sam Raimi. And, like...
Well, he hasn't made anything since Oz, right?
No. That's a problem that I have not seen widely discussed. I mean, he's one of my heroes.
Sure.
But, like, we got to remember...
Tone down your expectations.
Yeah, he made a film for Disney before and it was very bad. I just think Fincher is, like, who is making films with the care that man is making?
Well, yeah, and I mean, again, I use this word in, it's going to sound like a backhanded compliment, but it's not, but the competence, right? Mm. Like, every scene you feel taken care of.
Yeah.
It's like, there's no dead spots.
And someone, I think, has to be a dictator to make that kind
that
of film.
That might be true.
Which he clearly is.
Yeah, I mean, I saw a lot of people put The Social Network on their best of the decade list, and I think that's understandable.
I think that's a perfect film.
It's very good.
He just makes these, and we have to do Letterboxd game soon. Long-time listeners to this show will know that my preferred mode of art is very chaotic. So when I say that Fincher makes perfect films, I don't even mean that they're, like, my favourite films. Because my favourite films are actually usually not perfect at all. If you look over there, you'll see a Blu-ray copy of the film Tammy and the T-Rex, which I saw the other day, which is a... unbelievable film about a dude who gets his brain surgically implanted into a T-Rex.
Sure.
Right? David Fincher is not making those films.
We might. He'd make a very different version, I imagine.
But there's just a polish that I think filmmakers spend the rest of their lives, like, trying to rip off.
Totally.
I mean, Fincher, this film inspires a glut of these kind of, like, very dark cop dramas. Mm.
That are all garbage, right?
They're
boring.
Yeah.
Seven could be such a boring film.
Sure.
If it was made in different hands, I think.
Sure. It's a not much happens. Film. No, not much happens at all. They're constantly missing.
They're behind. Yeah. There's like a weird shootout that's barely a shootout.
Yeah. I mean, I suppose we should quickly say... Well, maybe we don't have to.
Hmm?
So I gave this film 4.5 stars.
Oh.
I probably take off that half a star for the last murder. I think the film oversteps its mark.
That's really... Oh, Joseph.
I
would never have expected this from you. I think you don't have a moral compass, obviously, but I just think these aren't things that... That's really interesting.
If the rest of the film is at that tone, either the dog is coming to see us, I love... I think that works.
Oh.
There is... I mean, feeding a dude spaghetti versus Ida's coming over... Hello, Pooch.
Hey, Ida. How you doing? Well, she's panting.
Do you want to come say hello to the listeners of the Brad Pittcast? You know what? I had an awful thought the other day. Ida's very old. What if the Brad Pittcast lasts longer than my dog, Ida? Do we just have to do an episode of this podcast
in memoriam,
where I have to say...
Like an Oscars? Well, let's not say in front of her.
Oh, no.
She'll outlive us all.
I know, she will.
Sit down, Ida.
I think there is a big difference. I have to go and tell the dog to sit down, excuse me.
Joe's just positioning the dog. My jacket was on the sofa, which caused an obstacle, I think. He's got to have it perfect.
Here you go. Come in.
There she goes. Oh, no, not quite. She's walking in circles. Yeah, settled. Good girl.
There is a substantial difference between feed an overweight man SpaghettiOs and
trigger warning,
assault someone with a knife.
Yeah,
in the most
heinous,
horrendous way possible.
It's really upsetting.
And I just don't.
You also see, someone is coerced into doing that, and then you see, which generally this film doesn't show you the people who are complicit in the murders. They're just corpses or Like, it doesn't actually show the suffering.
No, but you see it entirely in his face. And I think
that's very upsetting.
In the commentary, Fincher said, like, we just couldn't show anything that happened. It had to be... I just don't think the film has to go there, to be honest.
I think that's really true. That's interesting.
I just find it excessive and, like...
Well, it doesn't add anything, right? Like, we already know... It doesn't give new information.
I guess the argument is, what are you meant to do for your last murder, if not some kind of heinous... But there's just... Yeah. I mean, the film's power, which is something I think you're reacting against in a way that you don't like as much, so maybe you won't agree. The film's power is that it's a sci-fi film, and it doesn't reflect on our real life. And, like, that murder does reflect unpleasantly on terrible things that happen that stop it from being entertaining.
That's interesting.
That's all I
got to
say.
No, I buy that.
I'm going to redo the letterbox.
I'm really interested in this. I reckon...
We've actually talked about this film on Letterboxd because of our Christmas episode.
I want to guess the average score.
Well, that, if you know, the Christmas episode will help you do
that. Okay.
4.2? 4.3.
Oh.
You're very close. Has anyone given this film... 140 people have given this film half a star.
Well, I guess it depends on your criteria for rating.
Can I read a few of my friends?
Please.
So this is my friend Kai.
I think have we read Kai on...
We have.
What are Kai's
top four films?
Have they changed?
They have not changed. The Last House on the End of the Street, which is an extremely unpleasant, like, quasi-snuff film.
Great.
Kai and I have identical tastes, basically. Interesting. A Moment of Innocence, The Iron Rose, and a film I've never seen called The Emperor's Naked Army Marches On. So, sure. Kai is
It will
singular.
Not surprise you if you've not seen any of those movies.
Here's a review. I chose this one because it's closer to what you said.
Huh.
3.5 stars is from
Kai. I think, which is where I would roughly sit. Really? Somewhere between 3.5 and 4.
Still gripping, but this time around I found it really awkwardly paced and structured. 7 sins don't exactly lend themselves to the 3-act structure, says Kai.
Sure.
Do you agree with that?
I don't think those are the problems necessarily.
Sure.
I think the pacing is... I think it is awkwardly paced, but I think that serves the film.
I think it's perfectly
paced. Okay. It's awkwardly paced in its sense as a... If you were to go in thinking it was a detective serial killer film, the pacing is awkward because they're always behind things like slow down and speed up. But that's the point, right? Like, it's disorienting. So I think it depends what you mean by pacing.
Another one. This is Joe Lynch. Joe Lynch is actually a filmmaker.
Oh.
He's made some... He has an uneven filmography, but some of them are pretty good.
I hope he doesn't listen.
I almost threw him over... he won't listen. Okay. I think he follows me on Twitter.
Okay. Oh, shout out to Joe.
Do I have to cut off? No, I don't.
I mean, look, I have an uneven creative record as well.
Yeah,
we all do.
If I was let loose upon the world and every idea I got to, you know, we'd be fucked. Lynch made a really good film called Mayhem.
Okay.
Which is like a pretty... I enjoy it. It's good. He's a passionate filmmaker and film watcher. His top 4 films. Die Hard. Have you seen it?
I don't think I have.
Although
I feel like I have. I know all the stuff about it.
Exactly. That's my problem
with
Die Hard.
Have.
I can't... On Letterboxd, I've given Die Hard 3 stars. That's only because I came to it very late.
Yeah.
And the watching of it was like a checklist, like, yep, seen Die Hard.
Sure.
And I knew everything that happened.
I feel like that about the first Indiana Jones film, which I watched very late. And I was like, I guess this is what Indiana Jones is.
I was thinking about the, like, classic films that I haven't watched that I need to watch. And I'm so fucking bored by the ideas of watching them because it's just...
Yeah. Well,
I know all the shit that happens.
I watched Jaws for the first time recently. Pretty good.
I don't like Jaws so much.
It's good. It's obviously good.
The director of the film I can't talk about talked extensively at the screening yesterday about how Jaws is the film that activated him.
Interesting.
I think filmmakers of a certain age, you see Jaws and you're like, particularly if you're a genre filmmaker.
Sure.
Am I going to get sued by Universal? They'll sue me. They won't sue you. You know,
I hope so. Brad Pitt Cast Limited gets
versus,
the bankruptcy.
Oh, God. The last episode of this podcast should be like the last episode of Seinfeld.
Where
it should
just
be everyone who's wrong.
All our enemies.
Peter Handke,
one
of the other people who hate us.
Steven Spielberg.
Someone unfollowed me on Twitter recently who is a fairly prominent film critic uh-huh. in the circle. and I heard on the down low, it was because of my opinions in this podcast.
For real?
Yes.
God, I gotta check my opinions in this podcast.
And someone else...
It's nice that they listened.
It's nice, but they stopped because they found
Not only did they stop, they unfollowed you. Not my opinions?
No, everyone likes you, Dan.
Oh, that's true.
Another person said to me recently, maybe I'll call him out, because it's possible that he listens to the podcast and this is why we said it. Craig Matheson, recently, who is a film critic, mm-hmm. a very excellent film critic, posted about the film Sweet Smell of Success, and I am...
Oh, yeah, you know, that's streaming,
on
I think,
Stan.
On Stan now. I've noticed that recently.
If you live in Australia, you
Watch
the
Sweet
it.
Smell of Success. It's a great film.
Possibly the best film ever made. I think it probably is. Increasingly, wow. I think wow. it's the best film ever made.
I mean, I obviously can't make that claim, but it's great.
Craig posted about Sweet Smell of Success, mm-hmm. and I replied, and I was like, probably the best film ever made, because I'm a one-note human being. And Craig replied, in the nicest possible way, you are a cookie laced with arsenic, which is a line in that film. And I don't think I'm very cookie laced with arsenic on Twitter. I think I am cookie laced with arsenic on this program.
Funny.
Craig, if you're listening, I loved that, because...
It's touching.
I think... Which one of us is...
Uh-oh.
Which one of us is Tony Curtis and which one is Burt Lancaster? That's saying which one of us
yeah.
is snivelling and which one is evil.
Am I Tony Curtis? Wait.
No.
Is Burt Lancaster evil in that?
Yeah.
I'm just trying to get the dynamic. It's a while since I've seen it. Well, it's not that long, but yeah.
Sydney is the one who wants to be Burt Lancaster, and Lancaster
right.
is the one pulling all the strings that's actually revealed to be, like, undone by
Freudian. I don't think we're not that dynamic, surely.
I hope not. Joe Lynch's other favourite films, Dawn of the Dead. Have you seen that film, George A. Romero?
No, I would like to.
It's a fantastic film.
Yeah, I should see that. So many films to watch.
Dan. Something Wild. Have you seen that?
No, I don't even know if I know it.
It's a Jonathan Demme film, so
oh,
director
yeah.
of Silence of the Lambs.
Yeah, yeah.
Lots of people love that film. I'm not so big on it.
Okay.
Schindler's List. We've talked about before.
I used it in a high school presentation about
Did you?
Something. I guess the Holocaust.
It would be pretty weird if it was something yeah, else. Like be. Henry VIII or something. You're real stretching.
Yeah.
I think that's a terrible film.
Okay, sure.
I think it's one of Steven Spielberg's worst films, and I think most of his films are pretty terrible.
Mm-hmm.
That's the sound of someone unfollowing me on Twitter. Joe Lynch's review, 4 stars. Do I need to say how fantastic this movie is? Well, comma, it is. Darius Conji is the man behind the grime. Full stop.
Mm.
Fincher. Full stop. Again.
I have to say, I'm fascinated by reviews like that. Like, unbelievable. 4 stars.
Yeah.
I love that.
No, it's my
I'm such a fan.
Lights,
I think
camera, Jackson.
There was a lot of that. Wait, oh, yeah.
Go on.
Yeah. I was just going to say, when I was in America, I spent a lot of my time looking at Google reviews of restaurants. And the number of people who are like, this place is unbelievable. 3.5, 4 stars. Like, what are you doing? And that person's place, like, a service people are involved. Anyway, just give it 5 stars.
But that's why your worry about Letterboxd is that you're thinking that the ranking is objective. It's not. Everyone has an internal metric.
Yeah, but you understand that one of my key, like, ongoing traumas in life is an inability to appeal to internal authority. Like, I don't know how to judge those things.
You know what you think.
Sometimes.
This podcast has... healed that in you, Dan Dixon. Think about you in the first episode. I don't know what to say. What I think.
I have
about
to go back and listen.
I buffeted you pretty hard on 7 this episode.
I pushed back.
You did.
Yeah, but all with goodwill, you know.
Exactly.
And I could be wrong. That's the other thing. Is like I said, you could convince me otherwise,
but I didn't.
No, not yet.
Do you want a 5-star or a 1-star?
Let's go for. I want to hear a 1-star, which I'm sure I would disagree with.
Anyway, you'll see. This person's... You know what? I'm not going to say their handle.
Wow.
I'm just not. Their top...
Oh, God.
Their top
it's getting
four,
serious.
Their top 4 films are Gabby on the Roof in July, a very twee indie film, came out in 2010.
Sounds right.
Cold in July. A good film.
Okay.
A good film because it stars Don Johnson of Miami Vice fame.
And Watchmen.
And Watchmen, who's one of my favourite actors.
Sure.
We'll say it again.
Don Podson.
I knew it was good. I talked over it, but even still I could hear
I should have said Pod Johnson, I guess.
Pod Johnson. The Pod Johnson would be amazing. Sounds like it's very rude. Good film. Christmas in July by Preston Sturges. Have you seen a single Sturges?
Not to my knowledge.
Okay. I think you'd really like
him. Okay.
He makes a film called Sullivan's Travels.
I've heard of that.
Which, Oh Brother, Where Art Thou, is the name of the fictional film within Sullivan's Travels. The Coens adore Sturges. I think you'd like him.
I feel like you have like 12 Will Self books.
This shelf is almost Will Self.
A Will shelf. Sorry, I don't know what's wrong. I don't know what's wrong with me. Joe has a bookcase behind him. And I'd noticed one Will Self book at one end and then another Will Self book at the other end and then realised that in between, exclusively Will Self.
Have you read any?
No.
They're great. I know a lot of people find him very insufferable.
12, 13, 14, 15, 17.
I think this is everything.
Yeah, that makes sense.
I think this is everything.
I find him a bit much. I mean,
I haven't read any.
I've read in interviews.
Oh, sure. He's so smart, though.
He's obviously got a big brain.
Yeah.
He knows a lot of stuff, which isn't always the same. He's probably really smart.
I worked on a newspaper. I was the sub-editor on a newspaper that had a Will Self column. We were in Australia, and he would send it from London. I remember talking to the editor and being like, how the fuck do we have a Will Self column? And the editor said to me, that man writes so much content, there's not enough publications in the world for it. It just comes off him constantly.
Is he all right?
I mean, do I want to say that? But I mean, I can reflect on it to soften the blow.
Sure.
He was a heroin addict.
Okay.
And I was an alcoholic. And I have substituted things. I've become so much more productive afterwards. And part of that is because it's really hard to write when you're fucked up.
Sure.
And part of that is because you just need structures in place to keep yourself constantly moving. It's my favourite authors on this shelf.
It's a great shelf.
Maggie Nelson, Flannery O'Connor, Ray Bradbury. That's it. That's my canon.
It's a wonderful...
This person's fourth film is 4 Days in July. Oh, I understand. So
they're all July-based.
They're all July-based. There's a reason I didn't say this person's name. About an hour into this movie, Morgan Freeman takes Brad Pitt to bribe an FBI agent for information about library reading. Is that even legal? Pitt asks. Freeman literally waves his hand at the question. Legal? Illegal? These things don't apply. This payoff leads them directly to the perpetrator's door and a shootout chase. Internalized justifications of unscrupulous law.
Joe looks as weary as he sounds.
Unscrupulous law violations are common to the kinds of movies about the police. The ends justify the means. I shouldn't exactly expect this movie to be different, but the precise language showing a through line from these early computing days of privacy violation to the current widespread surveillance state we find ourselves now upsets me. This goes on and on.
I mean,
this movie is White Flight the movie. The only answer people can come up with is running away because crime is a disease. It has nothing to do with systems or power relations or income.
It's not going to get better.
That's gross, especially when you layer your movie with ironic detachment so as to avoid culpability for the images you create.
Let's do a 5-star.
You know something?
Uh-huh.
When I grew up in the 90s, there was a lead singer of a band called U2, and that man's name was Bono.
Mm.
And Bono made everything political in a way that was artificial and hollow. He diagnosed everything as being like a need to speak justice to power in a really false and unconvincing way. I wish we still had the attitude about Bono then that we have now.
Yeah.
Now... we love that. Yeah, we love the idea that everything is diagnosable in like this.
The value of the discourse is dependent on how swiftly we can turn something into a political question.
Yes.
It's a shame.
Of course, everything is political. Yeah, but that doesn't mean that the film is bad.
No.
You know what? This might be a good review if they gave the film 5 stars.
That would be very funny.
Do you want a 5-star?
Oh, please. Palate cleanser. Sorbet.
You seem like you didn't want me to put you on that one, Dan.
No, I was upset by the 1-star review.
Do you want a 5-star and then a final 1-star or another?
Oh, end on a 5-star. Okay. End on a 5-star. Oh, we can do 5-star, 1-star, 5-star.
We should also say at this stage, my sense is you listening right now.
Hello.
You might be a first time.
We tend to have greater listener numbers on the more popular films. This is one of the most popular films.
This is probably the most. Contemporarily popular. Yeah, that's film
probably that maybe five. So far. Oh, that we've covered so far, absolutely.
So, if you've listened all the way through,
well, if you're here, rate us 5 stars on iTunes.
People did after the last episode.
Yeah, throw us a review. Email us at thebradpittcast@gmail.com, please. Yeah, with questions, comments.
I'd love it. I'd
constructive love feedback, compliments.
I would love constructive feedback.
Yeah, actually, yes. Do you think we should have more segments? Do you think what we should? What other actors should we cover? I don't know.
What other actors should we cover is a good question.
I actually have. So do give me the 5-star review, and then I've got a question for you that I think might incense you.
I was trying to find a really low rated one, but everyone fucking gave this movie 5 stars.
Well, we can end the Letterboxd segment with a 5-star.
Oh no, I can't. I'm going to read this person's review, but their top 4 is not interesting enough for it to count as the last one. Their review is Fincher top me.
Sure.
I love that.
I mean, this is a camp film, right?
Sure. Oh, this person's... And you know what? I'm clicking the follow button right now on this person's top 4 films. I love films. That. Love Streams, directed by John Cassavetes.
Masterpiece. I was going to ask a practical question on the podcast. Can I borrow some Cassavetes films?
Yeah, absolutely.
Wonderful. Thank you.
You should start with Love Streams.
I'm about to go to Brisbane. I might take him to Brisbane.
Will you be able to...
Oh, that's a good question. Hey, we'll sort this out after the podcast. Joe, continue with the top 4.
No, I think we should continue that conversation. Dan might not have a way of watching region-locked DVDs on his laptop in Brisbane. Anything else to say of interest to the listeners? Multiple Maniacs. Again. The John Waters film. Massively important filmmaker for me. Corel. The Reign of Werner Fassbinder film, massively important filmmaker to me. And The Umbrellas of Cherbourg. Out of those 4 films that I just mentioned, you would probably most like The Umbrellas.
I think I've heard of that.
It's a musical. All of it's sung, but it's like very beautiful.
Okay, I love beauty.
And sweet.
I love sweetness. Sweetness and beauty.
What more could you ever want from your life? This review. What's in the box? What's in the fucking box? Exclamation mark. 5 stars, I should say. Very long review. I'll just take this. Of course, the ending. Dark, nihilistic, beautiful, horrifying, intense. Even though it had been sadly spoiled for me, it was never anything but the highest form of suspense.
Mm-hmm. I think that's fair. It does. Even knowing the ending doesn't diminish its... Did you say that person's name?
No, I didn't. They're great. Michael Audet. Audet.
Shout out. I have a question for you.
Go on.
I don't know when this podcast is being released, but the Oscars may have been, they may not yet have, depending on a few things. But Brad Pitt has been doing a lot of speeches for receiving awards. He's been making a lot of jokes during those speeches, often about his personal life. Do you think Brad Pitt has a writer's room, or do you think he's writing them all himself?
He's writing them himself.
Definitely?
I strongly believe that.
I want that to be true.
You know how much he hates the machine.
Yeah, he really does.
You know how much he wants to just be the guy in the cap, like giving people the money to make movies and strolling onto set and hanging out with sculptor Thomas Hausiger, who I discovered recently is his best friend.
Yeah.
He doesn't have a writer's room.
I think this is the vision of Brad Pitt I want to maintain. It's like Drake, you know, when we found... I mean, Drake has other problems, obviously. But there was a time when the biggest problem with Drake was that he may not write his own raps.
Sure.
And I think it struck me. I think I may have seen like an offhanded remark about Twitter about like Brad Pitt's writer's room jokes. And
people
because they've got to have a backlash. You can't say the discourse doesn't allow you to say one thing for a long time. You've got to reverse it at some point. And
particularly
that's just what's happening.
I think the tweet that you're referring to was very pro Taika Waititi.
That's right. I did see that.
And do you know what I saw recently? Jojo Rabbit.
You saw it?
I think it's one of the worst films ever
made. Yeah, it looks like one of the worst films ever made. I have warm feelings towards all. I think Thor Ragnarok is probably the best Marvel film. I think
he's...
Boy is maybe a great film.
Whoa.
I really like Boy. I don't love Hunt for the Wilder People.
Boy is a great film.
We can talk about that later.
It's the words are curdling on my lips. Do you really think
I love that film.
He's discount Wes Anderson. Oh, but you like Wes Anderson.
Yeah, huh? Except Grand Budapest, which we agree is a pile of garbage.
Jojo Rabbit does the same thing.
As Grand Budapest.
Literally. I mean,
yeah, that's
Grand Budapest
and
is
one of the
Nazis.
Things I hate about Grand Budapest.
Yeah. Wes Anderson's new film coming this year, July.
Oh, yeah. What's it about again? It's got a big cast.
It's called The French Dispatch.
That's right.
Which is actually a really good title.
I think it's got Frances McDormand in it.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's good.
And Timothy.
Oh, Timothée.
Timothée.
Yeah.
Problems. What are your... Do you want to do some... very poorly timed Oscar guesses.
Oh, Oh, boy. Because
people will be listening to us and going, fools, idiots.
At the earliest, yeah, we're recording after the Oscars next. I've seen an unusual number of Oscar films this year.
What have you seen?
I mean, let me have a quick look at the nominations.
You know what you could also look at? If you maintained it, you could look at your Letterboxd.
That's true, but I don't.
By the way, a number of you listeners...
Hello.
...have added me on Letterboxd, which has been such a joy.
I'll get on there.
I love looking at your top four films. Please feel free to add me. I'm very easy to find. I'm just Joseph Earp. There's a photo of me holding a flower.
Yeah.
And my top four films at the moment are Sweet Smell of Success.
Great film.
The Wicker Man.
Great film.
David Cronenberg's Crash.
Haven't seen it.
Watched it recently. And Larry Fessenden's Habit.
Haven't seen it. Okay, here's what I'm going to do.
Go on, please.
I'm someone who's very methodical, very careful.
Fantastic.
I'm going to just tear through all these things. Just going to say a name. Actor in a leading role, Joaquin Phoenix. Actor in a supporting role, Brad Pitt. Actress in a leading role,
Zellweger.
Actress in a supporting role,
Dern. Also,
obviously. Dern, yep. Animated feature film,
Klaus.
I don't know what that is. I would say I want Toy Story 4 to win. I think Toy Story 4 will win. It's got Forky in it. Forky can't win.
No one wants to award Forky. It's problematic.
Cinematography, The Irishman.
No.
Oh,
1917? Deakins for 1917 again. I betcha.
Sure, I have no idea. Costume design, Little Women. Directing...
Bong Joon-ho.
Or Quentin.
No, not
Quentin. Really?
It's Bong Joon-ho or Sam Mendes. If the Academy is disappointing, it will be Mendes.
I think it's going to be Quentin.
For director? Mm-hmm. I bet.
I don't know what I'm basing this on.
$20, it's not.
Documentary, American Factory, because the Obamas will get on stage. Documentary, Short Subject, never heard of any of them. Let's say Life Overtakes Me, that sounds good. Film editing. It's a shame that 1917 is not nominated for that, because that would be very funny.
It should be nominated, because they stitched all the cuts together.
That's true. I reckon.
I think Thelma for Irishman.
Yeah, for Legacy. I mean, it's obviously Thelma. A great.
I mean, she's won before. It's not such a big deal.
International, got to be Parasite. No way, it's not Parasite. Mm-hmm. Makeup and hair. Joker? Because
maybe.
That would be funny. I don't think it will be. Maybe Bombshell?
Yeah.
Because everyone looks real.
Everyone looks like... Well,
that's what we want. We want everyone to look like real people.
That's what we go to cinema for.
Music.
Hilda. Hilda's...
What about Marriage Story? Randy could get on stage.
Hilda, 100%, and she'll be wonderful, because do you know she was an ambient musician before she was a composer?
That makes sense to me.
Her albums are extraordinary. I listen to them to go to sleep.
Original song, I think I have literally never heard any of these.
Frozen 2, probably.
Maybe.
If you're listening to this and we're wrong about everything, that's kind of fun.
That is, for sure. I can't let you throw yourself away. I love Randy Newman. Randy Newman.
I love Randy Newman.
Best Picture...
I think it's Parasite. I think that, this will be the year.
Because everything else could get split, right?
It's been unstoppable.
I think it might be The Irishman.
No.
Production design, Jojo Rabbit. I reckon Jojo's going to sneak in one. And I reckon better production
design.
Well,
it'll definitely win adapted screenplay for Tiger.
Oh, of course, yeah. 100%. Did you see the Academy predicted from their Twitter account? The winners?
It was very
short
weird.
Film, memorable. Who knows any of them? Short film, live action. The Neighbor's Window, sound editing, 1917 for sure.
Definitely. You know, Taika Waititi already has an Oscar and he won it for... Maybe he didn't win, actually. Ignore me. Okay. He was nominated for an Oscar for Best Short Film.
I've seen footage of him at the awards.
Yeah, asleep.
Sound, yeah, exactly. Sound
you know mixing. What he is? You know what he is? Insufferable.
Okay.
I don't like
he seems
Taika
like a sweetie.
Waititi. No, insufferable.
Taika.
Taika, if you're listening to Sweden? The
bread. Yeah, sound mixing at Astra.
What?
I don't know. I don't know the difference between sound mixing and sound editing.
You've become a force of chaos.
I want The Irishman to win visual effects. I think it will be 1917.
Perfect.
Adapted screenplay, Jojo. An original screenplay.
Quentin. That will be Quentin's one instead of director.
That's... we'll see. Yeah, I agree with Quentin.
I listened back to a podcast where I made an earlier podcast the other day where I made a prediction that turned out to be right. And I heard myself say it, and I was like, I have to get in touch with Dan because he owes me $100. And then I realized that what I said was, I will give you $100 if I'm wrong. And you actually say, I'll take that, it's not a bet. And I obviously didn't register at the time.
What was the bet?
It was that Brad Pitt would get an Oscar nomination.
Oh, sure.
It's funny to listen to that episode because we also widely speculate that
He will win two. Oh, that's interesting.
We don't get nominated for two.
Oh, for Ad Astra. Still, well,
like, pro Ad Astra.
Yeah, but that's... I mean, the world seemed to mirror your...
distaste.
You know, yeah. Huh. Well...
our next episode is an episode on the film 12 Monkeys.
12 Monkeys.
We will have a guest for that episode.
I'm looking forward to it.
His name is Chris Elena. He saw the embargoed film with me.
Oh,
last
wonderful!
Night.
Well, you can maybe talk. Maybe you won't be able to.
I don't think so.
That sucks.
If you're a PR person for a big company, and you're listening to this podcast, and you know the film that I'm talking about, in which case you've already deployed a legal team to sue me.
Hopefully not me.
You are wrong about the film. This is the thing, right? When a film has a very long embargo,
They're worried about it.
They don't think that it will do well. Embargoed will do embargoed business. Mm. I embargoed my prediction too, because I'm technically not allowed to say anything. It's embargoed. Dad's just looking at me. I don't think he likes this bit.
No, I'm just... It took me a while to register what you were saying, but I understand now. It was very cryptic.
That's the best kind of joke. It's the one that, like, you've got a long...
Yeah, slow burn. That's what I like. We've established that earlier in this episode. Well, I think that was...
3.5 stars for 7.
Oh, I don't know, man.
What's the best film that we've seen so far?
If this is the first time you're listening, I have a lot of trouble working out the criteria by which I evaluate something. The best film we've seen... Legends of the Fall.
I'd kick you out of my house, Dan Dixon. No, it would be...
Seven's up there.
If you said Legends of the Fall, I would be like, oh, Dan has lost his mind. Which would be kind of fun.
Yeah, it would be interesting.
Never been in, like, close confines with someone. Like,
he's, like, totally unhinged. Yeah. Oh, unhinging.
I've been in rooms with plenty of people who are unhinged. It's just not the unhinging. What's the best film? Is it True Romance?
True Romance is good.
It's kind of
Seven's fun. Probably better than True Romance.
It's kind of funny to me that we've done, like, 16 films and you don't really like any of them.
That's not true. I do. I love very few films, I think. I think I'm often... I like watching films, but I think it's relatively rare for me to really, you know, get totally overwhelmed by a film. I'm like a real, like, 7.5 out of 10 for a lot of films.
It's like that Onion article. It's like Pitchfork rates all of music, gives it a 6.5.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, is cinema. Pretty good.
Don't say that. What is the best film that we've... Now I need to know. I
think
we should wrap
it off. Might be Seven.
What else have you liked?
I like Cutting Class.
Do you like it more than
Dark Side of the Sun? It's annoying, you know, because so many people... Most listeners, I think we might have even talked about this last week, that we have by far are on the Ad Astra episode.
It's our worst
And I wish
episode.
I could tell people, don't listen to that first, but I can't, by
Unless
definition.
Can you update
Maybe we
the
could
audio
make that
file?
The
bump.
Yeah, well, you can.
Can we?
We could, actually. We could be like, hey, guys.
Don't listen to this. No, you know what? That episode's pretty good. The episode just falls apart at the end when... I just don't want to talk about the film anymore.
It might be true. Interview with the Vampire is good. Interview with the Vampire, True Romance, Seven.
The top three.
Yeah.
What's your favourite Brad Pitt film? Oh, well, you know the answer. Burn After Reading.
That's right.
You said that on a podcast.
I did, yeah. I could feel like I could also say Moneyball.
You know something? I know, we've got to wrap up. I realised today an undiscussed thing about the brothers Joel and Ethan Coen. I just don't see it very often. They have a fetish for hair.
Oh.
The Man Who Wasn't There is about a barber. Anton Chigurh has weird hair.
Yeah.
Brad Pitt in Burn hair. After the Reading has weird hair. Have you seen Fargo?
Yeah, I love Fargo.
Peter Stormare has, like, weird blonde dyed hair. Buscemi has weird hair.
Yeah.
They all have... every film...
There's a toupee in... That's
sure. Miller's Crossing.
Miller's Crossing.
Great film. Yeah, Barton Fink, he has weird hair.
Yeah.
They love the hair.
Well, we'll on our Coen cast, we'll work through it.
There's an interview where they talk to Dick Cavett, and Cavett is... they're very young, and they're being very hostile, as they always are in interviews. And Cavett is like, is Barton Fink meant to be set in the head of the main character? And Cavett has a Band-Aid on his head.
Yeah.
And Ethan, like, posed, and his voice very low, says, no. By the way, speaking of cranial matters, why do you have a Band-Aid on your head? Speaking of cranial matters might be my favourite segue
That's
of all time.
Wild. They're two strange men.
You know they're not making films together anymore.
Seriously?
Joel's making a
they
Macbeth.
They broke up.
Joel's making a Macbeth by himself for A24 with Francis McDormand.
His partner, right?
Yeah, his for ages.
What happened?
They were roommates. McDormand, Joel Coen and Sam Raimi were roommates. Oh,
that's insane. But what happened to the Coens? Why have they...
I don't know. I hope it's not...
Yeah, I hope they're just trying it out.
The Wachowskis are not going to make films together anymore.
Seriously? After the five new Matrixes or the Matrices?
Only one of the Wachowskis is making that film.
I didn't know that. God, everything's falling apart.
Joel and Ethan didn't have a fight, did they?
I hope not. No.
Maybe Joel is just like, I really want to make a Macbeth movie. And Ethan's like, that's weird.
Yeah.
What happens if they uncouple and Joel makes like a series of the best films ever made and Ethan makes a series of the worst films ever made?
Oh, that
and
would
you
be,
realize that it was just Joel.
That sounds like a Coen Brothers film.
Joel used to be the credited director before the DGA rules allowed two credited directors. It was Joel and Ethan was producer and then they just... People call them the two-headed director.
Mm. Well, let's hope the Safdies stay together.
Safdies can split up. I only like one Safdie.
Fair.
And I'm not telling you who.
No, don't. Well, if they listen.
It's like a serial stuff. If the Safdies are listening.
I've made it.
Cast Dan in your next film.
I'll die 10 minutes in for sure.
But no, you could be the hero of a Safdie film. You have extreme Safdie Brothers hero energy, Dan Dixon.
I don't know what to make of that.
You could be like...
Because the good time... I mean, spoiler alert, skip 30 seconds, does not end well for either hero of their most two recent films.
You're the hero. It's a film called, like, The Professor, and you've, like, been loaned from the University of Sydney Library a rare copy of Moby Dick. And you lose it. And you go on a series of academic misadventures.
Sure, but they become increasingly violent and I become increasingly manic.
Hey, Safdies, if you're listening.
Sure.
We just made you $100 million. Yeah. Oscar winner, Dan Dixon. I appreciate that.
That's the prediction?
I'll
give you $100 if I win an Oscar.
Okay. There's no time limit.
No, zero. No.
Because you could get like a legacy Oscar.
Will you? I'll put it into my will,
like Kirk Douglas style.
I get an Oscar retrospectively. Joseph Earp gets $100 from my estate.
Like Robert Altman, he won an Oscar and he died like 2 days later. Yeah. Like that. What if you did become an actor?
I've never acted in my life.
Have you not?
No.
This is.
I've done improv.
Have you?
Yeah.
You tried stand up, didn't you?
No, I've never tried stand up, but I've done improv on stage.
Were you good?
I was okay. Yeah.
Were you funny?
Yeah.
Dan, wow, that's pure Safdie Brothers energy.
Huh.
Maybe the Safdie Brothers could make a great film about an improv troupe.
That's you, true. Yeah, you, I appreciate that.
Called Improv! Exclamation mark. See you next
yes
time.
Yes, and.
Yeah.
All right.
What's the inciting incident in a film about improv? Or are you just like...
It has to be a dispute around... the team structure.
You could make it that you're like, you dream of being like famous and there's like a really good improv artist who you like want to study.
And you become obsessed with them maybe.
That's just King of Comedy though.
That's true. It's a great film. Joker's just King of Comedy apparently. I haven't seen it.
It's a good film.
I'll check it out despite our promise.
Next time we'll be talking 12 Monkeys and or at some point soon we'll do a non-pinned episode.
Yeah.
We're running up to them.
We will have to. That'll be fun.
If I can sit Dan down and make him watch Oliver Stone's 4-hour cut of Nixon.
I can do that.
Or you can watch the 80-minute long Friday the 13th part 8.
We have to do that at some point. Maybe we wait till Halloween 2020 to do that. But we have to do that at some point.
Of course.
Yeah. Okay.
Thanks so much for listening.
Thank you for listening.
If you're a new listener, we drop a podcast every little while.
Yeah.
You can go back and listen from the beginning. They're all good. You'll have a great time. I'm obnoxious and Dan is polite.
Something like that. It switches sometimes.
You're never obnoxious.
Really? I feel obnoxious sometimes. I worry about, like, pushing back too much. Anyway, again, we'll deal with this off mic. Hey. I love you all.
Rate
and review on iTunes.
It would mean the
please
world.
Subscribe.
Say something to a friend.
Tell a friend. Listen to the Brad Pitt cast. Even if you're not a fan of Brad Pitt, you will become one.
Or maybe not.
It's the year of Pitt. Or not. And you can email us about how much you hate him.
You're a Pitt. You're the rat.
Yeah.
Separate things.
Bye.
See ya.